Glad to have you all with us this evening for our last IBRI colloquium of this fall semester. It's a pleasure to have with us Dr. David C. Bossard to speak on the topic Modern Research in Genetics and Evolution, Christian Commentary. Dr. Bossard is a graduate of Biblical Seminary here just a year or so ago, but before that time he got his doctorate in mathematics from Dartmouth, and he was a vice president of a think tank around this area for a number of years, and then after graduation decided he could run one on his own. He is now president of D.C. Bossard Incorporated and involved in contract work with the federal government, with Johns Hopkins University present. And he has also been getting into, as a hobby, working on the problem of mathematical modeling of evolution. Don't know whether we'll be looking at that this evening or not. Dr. Bossard, good to have you with us.
I approach this with fear and trembling because I have so much material here tonight, I'm afraid it's going to come out as a big porridge instead of something coherent. Let me just tell you what I'm doing here. I would like to talk about three subjects and three topics. Darwinism, this is the centennial of Darwin's death in April 18th, 1982, and it has been the occasion for quite a number of surveys or summaries in the secular literature about the state of Darwinism today, evolution. And I thought it would be worthwhile starting with that and sort of ask ourselves, well, what is the state of Darwinism? Secondly, I especially am interested in the subject of genetics, and I would like to say something about the way you can approach evolution from genetics and some of the mechanisms of change and some of the mechanisms of stability of the species in genetics. And then thirdly, I would like to say something about the Christian, how do you pull it together as a Christian? Now, I brought three people from my own area just in case we got into a fight here. I have to you understand this is research, okay? And, I reserve the right to change my opinions at any time. Hopefully not during the course of the talk. That would be rather hard to do. But, the outline you have in front of you has a reference to a bibliography. Now, the bibliography, the notable thing about the bibliography in the back is that it is exclusively, or almost exclusively, work that was done in the last year or two, this past year, and it is almost exclusively from the scientific literature, secular literature. There is an article from Christianity Today, which is very important for our third point tonight, but by and large, it's from the secular literature. And I guess you have to forgive me for having concentrated on the secular literature tonight. It is not because I don't believe Christians have something to say, but I think it's very useful as a Christian to know what the secular angle is on these things. We hear such things as punctuated equilibrium, which I'll talk about tonight, and you say, well, maybe this is something that was invented by Dr. Newman in order to fortify his Christian position. Well, no, it wasn't invented by Dr. Newman. It's a live issue in the secular literature, and that's what I want to talk about. Now, to supplement the bibliography, I have a 20 or 30 page a document with quotations from these references. I only have a few of these because they are rather expensive to copy. If you want one, I left one with Dr. Newman. I have about three or four more. I don't have enough for everyone, but if someone is really interested in reading what the secular literature does say about some of these areas, please pick up a copy, and if necessary, I guess I could probably manage to get another one. That is not a finished document. It is a document that is in being, and all I did was dump my computer at some point in time, and that's where you are. What I do, I have this computer, and I get this. Whenever I get a good quotation from the literature, I type it into the computer, and then I have a file of these quotations. And that's where I am now. That covers more territory than we're going to cover tonight, too. So you might look through that thing and say, well, why in the world did he discuss this? Did he put this in? He didn't have anything about it in his talk. Well, it's not just restricted to the talk. But let's get on with it. All right. First, let's say something about Darwinism. Work that Darwin did, it was published in Origin of Species in 1859, and you might, you know, if you didn't realize it, you'd think that maybe he all of a sudden descended upon Earth and gave some amazing thoughts which nobody had thought about before. Well, that's not quite the case. Before the time of Darwin, there were other views about evolution. And in particular, the evidence of the fossil record had indicated that there were some characteristics to the origin of species or the species which had to be explained in any kind of scientific description of the situation. The first thing that was evident in the fossil record at the time was the sudden appearance of species in the fossil record. For example, you'd be going along. Incidentally, I'm assuming the validity of the general time scale that is being published in the secular literature. All right, if you have disagreements with that, let's discuss that somewhere else, or you can fight with Dr. Newman or something like that. I'm, for the present time, accepting the geological time scale. The Earth about 4 billion years old, and life appearing on Earth maybe a billion years ago. I don't know. My theology is not based on that, but my theology doesn't refute that either. Okay, so we'll discuss that later. As I say, I'm probably going to dig a big hole for myself, and then in the last 10 minutes have to try to dig out. All right. Life started about a billion years ago, according to the geological record. But all of a sudden, in the space of just a relatively short period of time, maybe 30 or 40 million years, which is short when you consider the vastness of the effort, we have all the major phyla that are involved in the world today appearing in the record. And that was evident way before Darwin, the sudden appearance of species. Not only that, but you're going along and you see one development of life becoming more and more complex, and then you see a jump, and a new species appears, jumps, and you see jumps all through the record. And this was evident before Darwin, what I call the sudden appearance of species. And the explanation that was given at the time was something called saltation. Saltation simply means the sudden appearance of species in the geological record. That's what saltation is. But the explanation in the absence of anything else was spontaneous generation. These are life forms that just appeared. Now, the concept of spontaneous generation was generally accepted in the scientific world as a philosophical necessity, because if you weren't going to be a Christian, the only real alternative was to believe in something like spontaneous generation. And Pasteur was still not, hadn't done his famous experiments at this time. His experiment, which definitively showed that spontaneous generation was not possible, didn't come out until 1860, which incidentally was almost exactly the same time as Origin of Species by Darwin. So at this time, the explanation for sudden appearance of species was saltation, spontaneous generation. A big proponent of that was Lamarck. The second thing that was observed in the fossil record was that once a species appeared, it stayed for long, 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 long periods of time. We still have trilobites today, I don't know if we have them today. Do we have them today? I don't know if we have them today or not. But they existed in the record for many, 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 many millions of years, okay? Cockroaches, I guess that's one of the early beings. Once a species occurs, it tends to stay. And this was credited to a concept called essentialism. Essentialism would be the idea that there are essential characteristics of a species which a species cannot get beyond. There would be some variation in a species, but you can't get beyond certain basic features. So that was the explanation of stability. And then thirdly, there was the observation of progression and complexity. And there were various explanations for this, the creative work of God obviously being one, but perhaps some guiding force which would lead higher forms of life. So that was a situation before Darwin. And then Darwin came with his Origin of Species in 1859, in which he presented two hypotheses which were not unknown before, but they were not considered to be well fortified, let's put it that way. Common descent was one of his basic hypotheses, that all life forms are related by descent from a common ancestor. In other words, there was one, I don't think he'd quibble about one so much as a few, there were one or a few original life forms, and all life evolved from that. Okay, that's the concept of common descent. so that you and I and the chimpanzees are related in some way, way back in the geological record. There's a common life form which broke apart and produced you and me and the chimpanzees. I presume that's a possibility, according to his record. The second concept that Darwin pushed was natural selection, that the thing that caused the progression and complexity of the species was environmental pressure. Random processes would cause random changes. One guy's eyesight would be better than another guy's, but then ultimately the one that survived would be the one that was best fit to live in that environment that he was in. And so that environmental pressure and natural selection, meaning non-divine action, natural selection, was the driving force for development. Darwin also believed very strongly that that this natural selection had to produce gradual changes. He did not like the idea of sudden changes in the life forms. His response to the geological evidence that was around him at the time was that he was an agnostic about the origin of life. He didn't pretend to have any solution to that. He knew about Pasteur's experiments, of course. And so that left a big question mark in his mind about the ultimate origin of life. As far as the fossil record goes, the apparent sudden appearance of species, he credited the gaps in the record. He just said the record's incomplete. It's too imperfect for the preservation of transitional forms, is a quote from him. As regards the fixity of species, the fact that the species would have a stability associated with them, he denied the possibility of anything called essentialism. He denied that there was anything special about a species which would prevent it from becoming another species or another type of animal. But rather, he said that was simply because of the stability of the environment. That what would cause you to see these trilobites in a geological record for many, 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 many millions of years is simply the fact that their environment was suitable for them for that period of time. And where you see changes, it's because the environmental pressure force changes. Now, that was where Darwin was. And what happened in his day, according to my references, is that within about 10 years of the appearance of the origin of species, there was pretty much a general acceptance in the scientific community of the concept of common descent. Now, you might ask yourself why, and the answer is very simple, because of philosophical necessity. Because spontaneous generation had just been shown to be impossible, and incidentally, that was quite an effort on Pasteur's part to get that through, because scientists did not want to deny spontaneous generation, because the only alternative is creation. There was a vacuum, philosophical vacuum. So when the origin of species came, and Darwin was a smart man, he had very well documented what he had done. It gained general scientific acceptance in about 10 years. However, the natural selection, the mechanism for the change of species from one type to another, there was great disagreement over that. And in fact, there wasn't any resolution of the what we call classical evolution until around 1940, when they had what they call the grand consensus or the synthesis, evolutionary synthesis. And the spokesmen for that were Haldane, and Ernst Mayr, who is still publishing stuff in on evolution. And up until that time, there wasn't even any general consensus on the mechanisms for natural descent, and that's where things stood. Now, next I'd like to go into a little bit. I have to keep moving along here because I have a lot to cover. What's happened in the century after Darwin? What is the current assessment of Darwin's work? Well, let's go to the fossil record first. As far as the fossil record is concerned, one might fairly say it never did show very strong evidence for common descent. Mayr, who is this evolutionist who wrote this book here, says, as the record is preserved, it is a story of discontinuity. And elsewhere he says, it's almost more of an embarrassment to an evolutionist than a help. These are among the quotations I have in my document here. Recently, in the last 10 years, the fossil record, the time scale for the fossil record has become much more clearly defined in research. And
the gaps that were evident from the beginning have become even sharper. And so in the past 10 years, there have been a number of scientists who have proposed a concept called punctuated equilibrium. Punctuated equilibrium has two words. The punctuated means that there are points in time at which dramatic changes occur in life forms. Okay, you'll go from one species to another species in a very short period of time. And the equilibrium says once they attain their new form, they tend to stay that way. Now, I'd like to give you a quote or two. One is from Stanley, if I can find it. I'm in trouble with having 40 pages of stuff. It's hard to find the exact thing you want. Okay. What I describe in this book, this is quoting from Stanley, The New Evolutionary Timetable. What I describe in this book is evidence that evolution is not quite what nearly all of us thought it to be a decade or so ago. This evidence comes largely from the record of fossils, a record that until recently was not scaled against absolute time. The record now reveals that species typically survive for 100,000 generations or even a million or more without evolving much. We seem forced to conclude that most evolution takes place rapidly when species come into being by the evolutionary divergence of small populations. After their origins, most species undergo little evolution before becoming extinct. Now, this is a secular scientist. This is not a Christian, okay? The fossil record of horses. Now, all of you have been in high school, have seen the charts of the horses. The horses coming from the small little puppy-looking things down to the modern horse. The fossil record of the horses also testifies to an episodic tempo of evolution, meaning a punctuated equilibrium. And this is particularly notable because for decades, the record of the ancient horses was heralded as a classic illustration of gradual transformation. The equus kind of animal appears suddenly in the fossil record of North America, less than 3 million years old. This abrupt evolutionary birth of the modern kind of animal stands in sharp contrast to the stability of established horse species. In other words, the evidence of the fossil record is the sudden appearance of life forms that were not there before. And also, once a life form appears, it stays in the form that it is, structurally at least, until it becomes extinct. And these two comments are becoming more and more bandied about nowadays. So there are actually two camps. There's the classical doctrinaire evolutionist on the one side, and then these are the young upstarts on the other side. And the battles in the literature, which I have several quotes here, show this conflict. So, the first thing you have to realize about the fossil record is it is not a strong support for the evolutionary concept of common descent. And the punctuated equilibrium is one illustration of that, and this is not Christian scientists saying this. The next thing you observe about common descent, well, you know, if we have two life forms that have a common ancestor, then we ought to be able to talk about relationships between these life forms. Can you tell me what the ordering is of the life forms? Which was the descendant of which? And which one is related? How closely is this related to this? And the interesting thing about that is that relationships are still extremely hard to identify. And Ernst Mayr, again, this evolutionist, says, honesty compels us to admit that our ignorance concerning these relationships is still great, not to say overwhelming. In other words, although the common descent hypothesis requires you to postulate relationships between life forms, it's hard to nail down what those relationships are. And it remains hard today. Concerning natural selection, the big issue is the continuity of the descent, the gradual evolution. And the best thing to say, I have to keep moving on here, the best thing to say about that is that there is a strong argument against gradual evolution today, and to the extent that that is an obvious requirement of natural selection, if environmental pressure is indeed going to cause changes, and only environmental pressure, then it's hard to imagine how that happens as suddenly as punctuated equilibrium would require. Okay, the question is stability of species. The question is, does the stability of the environment say at all? If the environment is stable, does it necessarily, if a species is stable, does it necessarily follow the environment was stable? And the question of mechanisms for change, Darwin was dead set against the concept of essentialism, the concept of a species having certain characteristics about it that cannot be changed. But what are the mechanisms for change?
environmental pressure, random change, the so-called hopeful monsters, which is a buzzword in some people's minds. I'll discuss more about this in the genetics later on. Finally, I just wanted to mark one more thing about the Darwinism, the Centennial Review. Karl Popper is a philosopher, I think he's English, from about a couple decades ago. I mean, he's still alive, but I mean, he was at least until recently. But he had published a bunch of philosophy about what makes a science. And basically he said that a thing is not a science unless that can be falsified. Falsifiability of a hypothesis is a necessary requirement for a science. And his comment about evolution is there is hardly any possibility of testing a theory as feeble as this. Does the theory offer testable predictions? Yeah, the prediction of gradualness, and it doesn't appear to be holding up too well. I thought I'd just close this section with an aside on some human origins. Obviously, you're interested in the question of where we came from, especially if you are not a creationist. And there's an interesting quote. There's a couple of places that comment about this that I found. One quote, human ancestors are looking less and less like other mammals these days. Indeed, many of them would feel more at home in origin than they would in descent. Now, if you think about that for a minute, that sounds kind of interesting. Because I think that would square pretty well with Christian opinions. Now, where are the evolutionists today? Are they Christian believers? No. Because they're still caught up with this philosophical necessity. They don't want to be creationists. The only alternative is some sort of evolutionary position. And what they are finding, however, is that the doctrinaire evolution, as put down by Darwin, is being more and more questioned, and so they are on rather strange grounds right now. I have to stop now and go to the next section, and that is the genetic commentary on evolution. Now, what I want to do, what my real interest is in my work, or my hobby, as Dr. Newman says, is to see what kind of scientific basis there is for genetic change, for genetic variation. Now, this stuff that I'm going to discuss falls under the category of microevolution. There are two kinds of evolution you might talk about. Microevolution would be evolution which involves just variations within a general species, like one kind of butterfly and another kind of butterfly are different, but they're both species of butterfly. Macroevolution has to do with changes that go from dragonflies to butterflies, okay, or something. So whatever, I don't know what the relationship of those is, neither does Mayer. But that goes from one dramatically different form to another dramatically different form. That would be macroevolution. And the whole issue of Darwinism is that he claims that the mechanisms that we're going to look at, which provide the answer for microevolution, also apply to macro. And that's the debatable issue. But let's talk about mechanisms for genetic variation. Now, what I'm going to talk about are things that I believe can be substantiated scientifically. And therefore, a Christian position which addresses the subject of evolution must admit either they deny the validity of these experiments, which is possible, or they have to include in their concept of evolution the kinds of changes that are talked about here. Now, one of the things that's been discovered in the last decade or two in the investigating of genetics is that the cell has marvelous mechanisms both to induce variation in generations and to promote stability in generations. And you might consider the descent of life forms, meaning from generation to generation, as a tension between the mechanisms for variation and the mechanisms for stability. Let's look at some of the mechanisms for variation. First is the normal Mendelian genetics. Now, most of you are acquainted, I presume, with the fact that male and female egg sex cells generally have half the right number of chromosomes, okay? Dr. Stiles is probably going to take me up on this one. I don't care. I don't worry about little trivial facts, okay? And in order to get a fertilized cell, you get the half of the chromosomes from the egg and half from the sperm, and you have a full, complete chromosomes. And as a consequence, the part of the chromosomes that come from the male would have one set of genes with one variation of characteristics. From the female, another set of genes with another variation of characteristics. When they come together, there is some kind of a give and take as to what the characteristics of the offspring are going to be. And you have the subject of recessive and dominant characteristics and so forth and so on. This is something that Mendel demonstrated quite dramatically in the late 1800s in his experiments with sweet peas, I believe. So that's one kind of variation, variation in the color of the hair, variation in the size of the person. And you can imagine that if there was a dramatic advantage in being tall as opposed to being short, that perhaps over thousands of years, all else being equal, there might be a tendency for the tall people to survive better than the short ones. I don't know. Maybe that might well happen. But anyway, that is one mechanism for variation. A second mechanism for variation is errors in transcription. Now, I really cannot go into the whole subject of the DNA and the coding for life that is contained in the DNA and the RNA. These are molecules that are in the cell. Every cell of the body has what you might call a microscopic blueprint for the entire body. And these are coded into molecules called DNA and RNA. But once in a while, these molecules have to be copied in the process of creating other cells or other life forms. And once in a while, in the copying process, there will be an error, a random error made. And when this random error is made, it may cause a change in the thing that was copied. Now, that's a form of variation. It is what you might call random errors. One might suppose that normally those random errors are not advantageous. They might be harmful. But anyway, that's another mechanism for change. And you can imagine that some of these things that originally started out as a transcription error might actually go over the course of time into a slightly different subspecies or species. A third mechanism is damage to information cells. Molecules, you've heard of the dangerous effects of radiation. Well, one of the things that it does is either it could damage the DNA and RNA directly and actually change the code, or more likely actually, it might damage some of the enzymes, the molecules that hang around the DNA and RNA, and because those molecules are damaged, cause unfortunate consequences. I hope I have time to go into that a little bit more in a few minutes. A fourth mechanism is genetic insertion. There's a colloquial term called jumping genes. And what this means is that transposition means that if you have a gene in a chromosome, let's just draw a chromosome here, and here's the location of a gene. This is a little bit of code that tells you what color your eyes are going to be, let's say something. Now, a transposition means that you look at that code there, and all of a sudden you discover that there's a copy of that code up here, and here's another chromosome, there's the same copy of the same code there, and maybe the code is actually repeated several times, and you'll find exactly the same repetition sequence over here, and maybe you'll find it over here. In other words, the code has been transposed to other different places in the genetic material. And when that occasionally, when that occurs, that may cause changes. Now, I'll explain that in a few minutes. If you just bear with me for about 10 more minutes, I'll give you a specific example of how that can happen. Fifth mechanism for change is parasitic DNA. Now, one of the things that's been discovered about viral infections is that the way the virus actually works in many cases, I don't know if this is universal, but at least in many cases, is that the virus actually comes into a cell and takes over the reproductive mechanism and forms its own. It's sort of like you walking into the General Motors assembly line with your Volkswagen plans and converting the General Motors assembly line to produce Volkswagens until you destroy the General Motors assembly plant and you go somewhere else. And now you got a whole bunch of Volkswagens. The virus goes into the cell of the bacteria, for example, and we'll use the bacteria's own assembly line to produce more virus. And that's what you would call parasitic DNA. These are things that might cause changes in a cell. Mechanisms for constancy, on the other hand. The very fact that every expression of a cell, every characteristic of a cell, ultimately goes back to a coded sequence, which is copied, in most cases, faithfully, is itself tends towards stability. In other words, you tend to produce whatever it was in that code. And so that's a mechanism for constancy. A second one is the cell itself. I don't have time to go into this, but Dr. Newman, in some earlier discussions on science and the origin of life, has talked about the cell as a remarkable vehicle for preserving life and preserving the processes which reproduce life. Thirdly, the question of transposition of codes. Now, I mentioned transposition in the previous as a mechanism for variation, and the fact is, the same thing can be a mechanism for variation or for constancy. Why? Just to ask the question, why would the gene copy itself several times in the chromosome? Because there are enzymes which, when this thing is copied, when this gene is copied, they check the copy with the next replication of the gene. And so the fact that there are multiple copies of a gene will help it to help the gene to correct itself. In case one copying job was not done well, these are called replicases or something like that. There are enzymes which proofread the genes because the gene copies, the code for the gene is several places in the cell. And so that proofreading enzymes are a powerful mechanism for stability, for guaranteeing that what is copied was really the true thing. Now, what I want to observe is that these are mechanisms that are legitimate, scientifically verifiable, and observable mechanisms for genetic change. Only in the last couple of decades have these things been elucidated, and there still is it's just the tip of the iceberg. There's so much more to be done. But these are the basics for legitimate commentary on how life forms evolve or change in the microevolutionary sense. Now, I'd like to give a little aside for about 5 minutes on the biological tension of constancy versus change, and talk a little bit about some viruses and get into some stuff along those lines. The fact about viruses that you find very disconcerting if you went to the doctor and got an inoculation against the flu virus is that if you get a shot for the flu virus this year, that shot may not be very good next year. And why is that? The reason is because the viruses have a tendency to change their genetic structure. And your flu inoculation is only with regard to a particular virus, and when it's changed, it's no longer good. So what happens is for the virus, the tendency, the mechanism for variation is actually a survival mechanism for the virus. I mean, we don't care for it very much, but that's a fact. What? And for the doctor. The doctors get a good, that's right, they can sell you a new flu vaccine next year. Okay, I'd like to quote a little bit from Holland. The considerably less faithful replication of viral RNA may be a factor in the ability of the virus to adapt to its environment. Now what happens is, remember we talked about proofreading enzymes. And the virus, there is a general absence of these proofreading enzymes. So whereas the viruses, whereas the DNA, the normal cells, would have these proofreading enzymes which make sure that the copy is letter perfect, on a virus it tends not to be there, so therefore the error rates in copying a virus are much greater. And therefore the virus tends to change. Okay. Errors in the replication of DNA, well I won't read that, that's getting too complicated. During an epidemiological study of poliovirus, during a recent poliomyelitis epidemic that spread through unvaccinated communities, the viral RNA changed slowly and progressively so that the United States isolate of June 79 differed from the original Netherlands isolate in May 1978 by 15 places in the RNA. In other words, the RNA can be considered as a bunch of codes telling you what kind of virus you're going to have. And they looked at the Netherlands virus in 1978 and the United States virus a year later, and they found 15 places in the code where it was changed. They're actually able to read this code nowadays, which is an amazing thing. So, 30,000, 50,000, I don't know exactly how many. I mean, it's not very many, okay? The answer is, I don't know what the number is, but it's large. It's large, yeah, it's in that order of magnitude. So, the transcription error rates in the case of viruses is actually a mechanism to help them keep away from the police. Now, another version of virus operations is genetic insertion and dormancy. Now, this is most fascinating. This is Peltz, which is another reference that those of you who get this topic can look at in more detail. And the article is called Mark Tashney's Molecular Mission. Mark Tashney was the first scientist to actually isolate what is called repressor genes.
Repressor genes. And what happens to the Lambda virus, which was discussed in this article, is, now here's a bacteria. Lambda comes waltzing in and starts taking over the DNA. Okay, so here's the DNA for the Lambda, for the bacteria, and this is the production line for the Lambda, this is the production line for the bacteria. The Lambda comes in here and starts taking it over and producing more Lambda virus. Okay, that's fine. But the mysterious thing is, why is it once in a while this process will just halt in its tracks? In other words, the Lambda virus will come in and it'll just sort of sit there doing nothing for a long period of time. Now that's the original question. And the answer is this, and this was the result of this article. Here's the DNA. Think of it as a long string with it's got a lot of text and codes and numbers and so forth on it, perhaps. And what happens is the DNA virus, the Lambda virus, comes in and cuts the DNA for the bacteria and separates it and puts its own code in the middle. Okay? So now we have the new bacteria virus actually has inserted some code from the Lambda. And normally what that does is it tracks copying mechanisms and it starts copying itself like mad and produces more Lambda. But occasionally, it'll produce a particular enzyme which parks right here. We'll call that right there. The enzyme is a little molecule which parks itself right at the place where you would start copying for the Lambda. And when the enzyme is parked there, the Lambda can't be copied. It's being blocked. So what it does is, it stays in the DNA for the bacteria, but it's dormant. It's not doing anything. Now the bacteria, being a nice faithful bacteria and having good ideas of reproduction and so forth, forms a baby bacteria. Okay, here's another bacteria. And believe it or not, there's that little Lambda virus sitting right in there, the DNA code for the Lambda virus. But as long as that repressor is sitting there, that Lambda virus is just going to stay. Now, something happens. Usually what happens is they have what they call an SOS signal. The bacteria has, when something happens like radiation, might destroy that, or when something happens which is dangerous to the bacteria, it'll start producing some special SOS enzymes. And what these SOS enzymes do is they come along this, this is a very colloquial explanation. They come along this molecule, this DNA, and they start cutting, they start getting rid of these enzymes that were preventing certain parts of the DNA from being copied. It's not just here. All along the DNA, there are these little things that prevent parts of the DNA from being copied. Okay? And this SOS enzyme comes along and starts cutting those. Well, as soon as it cuts the thing that keeps the virus from being copied, believe it or not, the virus starts getting copied again. So the bacteria's defense mechanism to build antibodies or whatever it was trying to build for itself succeeds in activating the virus once again, and you get virus back again. Well, what is suggested is that this ability to insert RNA in a part of a DNA and then just be copied, perhaps in a dormant mode, may result in some genetic changes. Okay? Can you see now how you might have a chromosome with a gene sitting here that might end up over here? At least in theory, you can imagine how it might happen. And these kinds of changes are the sort of things that are being investigated very heavily in genetic research today, and they would be legitimate ways of getting changes in the genetic structure. Okay, that's enough about the Lambda virus. There's another kind of variation which has just came out just this past month. I think it's hot off the press, and that is a particular cancer phenomenon. And if I look at the article, I can tell you what kind of cancer it was.
I think it had to do with the bladder or something like that. If I look at my Nature article, it doesn't matter. I guess I could I can explain what happened anyways. What happened in this case is, well, they said, well, probably cancer is caused the same way. There's some kind of normal gene. Here's the code for a normal gene. And probably something happens at one end or the other. Maybe there's an enzyme sitting there which blocks the normal production of that gene, and the result is cancer. Well, in this particular case, they discovered that wasn't the case, that the cancer gene was exactly the same as the normal gene, except for one bit of the DNA code. Now, you know, usually you think, let's not look at the, let's say that the cancer gene was caused by an error in the transcription or something like that. But in this particular case, the error is in the DNA code in one little bit. Now, if you were at my talk last time, you would realize that it takes three of these little nucleotides, they call them. It takes three nucleotides to code for one amino acid, which produces one molecule in a which is one molecule in a protein. Okay, so they were looking, you know, for changes in the amino acid structure or something like that. Well, this one bit change in this gene caused a wild growth of this particular cell, and that was so there's an example in virus research of how a small change can in the coding mechanism can cause a dramatic result. Okay. Summary of this work in genetics, and there's a lot of quotes that maybe afterwards, if we have time, if you have any questions, maybe I can pick up some particular ones. The references, the names that are given in the outline here refer to references which you have the bibliographic reference to, and I have some quotes to them. There are mechanisms for change in the cell. They are essential to the life processes. Adaption to environment is a documented fact, and some fundamental mechanisms of change to allow this, certainly allow this to occur. To this extent, within species evolution or microevolution does occur. Small random changes can result in discontinuous changes of the offspring, for example, take cancer. The question of species is still very unsettled. Even the evolutionists, like Mayer and so forth, recognize that the question of what is a species is a very elusive question. None of the above microevolutionary causes explain the evolution of a complex functional organ, such as an eye or a brain, from its ancestral stock which did not have eyes or brains. One of the reasons for going into this microevolutionary stuff is that I believe that what is going to happen in evolution is that there is going to be a move away from the doctrinaire Darwinian evolution and natural selection, and there's going to be a move toward this type of explanation for evolution. And what's going to happen is evolution is going to appear, macroevolution, is going to appear to be better scientifically based because it is starting from scientific experiments in microevolution, in genetics, and they're going to make the giant leap and apply that to macroevolution. Okay? Now, the usual argument is, well, the reason we make a giant leap is because the time scale for macroevolution is so large that there's no way we could get scientific evidence for it anyway. And that's, you know, that's what you'll hear. The real reason that people insist on making that giant leap, which is a leap of faith if you better believe, is because of the philosophical necessity. If you don't want to admit the creator, you've got to postulate this kind of mechanism. There is no other choice. Now I'd like to say something about the Christian commentary on these things. And I hope that I cannot be accused of saying the devil makes the best press. And make all my comments about the wrong side of it and then have a very weak close. Well, let's trust that won't happen. The real issue, I believe, to the Christian is what are the essential elements of his faith that he must translate into his opinion about evolution. Now, there was a very good article. I thought it was very good. Maybe some of you didn't like it at all. In Christianity Today, editorial, just about October, on the subject of evolution. And I believe that his points are well made. And let me quote a couple of those. The issue is, what are the central things that we must believe as Christians about evolution? Now, the first thing is the subject of days. Now, I'm not going to go into a lot of these issues because I think they've been hammered to death in a number of discussions here. But he agrees, at least with me and Dr. Newman, I'm sure. In fact, I think he quotes Dr. Newman, that historically, that the 24-hour day in the creation account is not tenable. Now, the interesting thing is, and this is pointed out by Cantor, is that the church has in fact always offered various competing interpretations of the biblical passages related to creation. And one of the problems with today is that our minds are distorted by the advent of Usher and more recent science, and now we think that a lot of Christians believe that's the only biblical position, whereas historically Christians throughout the ages have held a variety of views on the subject of Genesis 1, 2, and 3, as far as the 24-hour days go. And he goes on, you ought to read the article, defending the fact that the days don't necessarily have to be 24 hours. Next, the question comes as to the age of the earth. And his opinion is, in summary, even the most loyal defenders of biblical inerrancy can find no hard data pinpointing the chronology of in the beginning. As biblical students, therefore, we must remain agnostic about the age of the earth. We have no biblical warrant for ruling out the validity of the commonly accepted geological timetable, let alone let scientists battle it out on the basis of the scientific evidence, but we should not bolster weak scientific positions with misinterpretations of the Bible conjured up for that purpose. So that's Cantor's view on day. Next, the subject comes of evolution. And it says, the Bible tells us little about the method of which God brought about the first humans into existence. Then it observes that in the Genesis account, the word create is used three times. And in other cases, in some of the days, the origin of plant life, for example, is particularly illuminating. Let the earth grass, is the literal interpretation, according to Cantor. This suggests not so much divine action of an immediate sort, but divine guidance of natural processes. And you can go on and read that. And thirdly, he observes the fact that that the definition of the word kind, that animals were to reproduce after their kind, the word translated kind does not mean species, but simply kind in a most general way, and could apply to anything from a Linnaean phylum to Linnaean species. It is even pressing too much into the phrase after its kind to interpret it to mean that God individually created each kind by a separate act. Now, that leaves you way wide open. And I must admit that I personally believe that God's creative activity is seen throughout the created world, and I find it very hard to believe that these sudden appearances of species were a result of natural processes. I believe that God had creative acts at those points. I also believe that development and genetic change is an essential part of God's mechanism for the continuity of the earth and life on earth, and that variation is a protective mechanism. But the important question is, what is the essential position that a Christian has to take? And I believe that the essential position is that God did create the world, that he interfered with its progress, if you want to call it interference, a number of times, beyond that, I believe that that when faced with a particular issue of why and how, that the Christian really is in a very good position vis-a-vis science. If the answer is found in natural laws or other immediate means of carrying out God's will, the believer is at full liberty to search out and find those laws and means. Investigating science for me is a way of honoring God by looking at the glory of his handiwork. And I believe every Christian can approach science in that way.
And I don't think that a Christian has to latch on. Let's take a specific subject of spontaneous evolution, spontaneous generation. If you realize that until 100 years ago, everybody believed in spontaneous generation, then you have to admit that it is not a strong biblical position to say that spontaneous generation is impossible. Now, I personally believe it is incredible, but not necessarily. That doesn't mean it's impossible. And it may be, by some amazing means, someone may devise a mechanism for spontaneous generation of the first life, first cell, or one cell, or something like that. That by no means is equivalent to saying that everything developed naturally. My viewpoint is, I very much doubt that spontaneous generation of life is possible without God's intervention. But I don't believe, as a Christian, I have to prove that it can't be. What I do as a Christian is face the scientific issue, and I feel that I'm at full liberty to search out and find the laws and the means. And if, on the other hand, the answer is found in the direct action of God, I am at liberty to accept that. The secular scientist, however, doesn't have any such liberty. He is forced by his secularism to seek only natural processes, governed by natural laws, to explain his observations. This places him in a box which imposes an essential limitation on his investigation. His invariable response when faced with unexplainable fact is to invoke unknown laws to explain what he sees. The intriguing thing that I find about true science is that the false inferences and incorrect conclusions of science tend over time to prove themselves out. Now, I believe that what's happening now is that the original conclusions of Darwin are being proved to be erroneous. And what is going to happen is a new set of conclusions will be adopted, a new set of hypotheses. And if those are not honoring to God, if they leave God out of the picture where God is involved, they will prove to be erroneous over the course of time. It may be beyond our lifetime. But I believe that what is happening is that God is sharpening the issues in many of these areas. And for a true inquiring mind, I believe the fact that the fossil record continues to show gaps is sharpening the issue for the scientists who want to disbelieve God. I believe for the honest scientist, it is a way of pointing them to God if they are honestly inquiring. I firmly believe that a Christian is in a better position to be a good scientist than a secular scientist, given equal ability, of course. Now, some people will object that the Christian isn't free to form conclusions. He's constrained by the inspired word of God. But this, in my opinion, is no constraint, really. First, because no amount of scientific investigation conducted in a correct manner will ever yield observable facts that contradict Scripture. Secondly, because scriptural statements that impact on science, for example, those concerning creation, almost always leave plenty of room for scientific investigation as to the exact cause. And if that exact cause is creative fiat, so be it. And a Christian as well is free to accept that. If that exact cause is some genetic change, that's fine too. The Christian's free to accept that. It is an essential part of the Christian belief that God is not in opposition with the created material universe. The heavens declare the glory of God. The skies proclaim the work of his hands, in the NIV, Psalm 19:1. Sin has imposed a breach in the spiritual realm, and to a certain extent, nature in opposition to man is in opposition to man, as described in the curses upon Adam and Eve at the time of the fall. False attempts have been made in all ages to place the material world and the results of natural science in opposition to God. These efforts are in conflict with the truth and smack of dualism, which pits God against nature. The dualistic philosophy is fundamental to the early heresy of Gnosticism and is part, perhaps not fully developed, of mysticism and asceticism throughout history. The modern counterpart of this error, in my opinion, is a tendency to pit science against Christianity and the implied assertion that the world today only appears to be what it appears to be, only appears to be old, although that appearance comes from numerous independent sources, but in reality is an age of only a few thousand or tens of thousands of years. I believe that God has declared in his word that the findings of science, truly and correctly pursued, will not contradict the truth, and that dualism implied in contrary assertions is false. And that's my position about the subject of evolution.
I am a creationist. I believe that God is going to sharpen true science, truly pursued, so that we will be able to see more clearly as time passes the evidence of God's direct involvement in the creation of the world. I believe, on the other hand, that there will probably be many things that we think of today as the immediate action of God, which may prove to be the result of genetics or other things. I believe a Christian is completely free to accept this. I don't believe that he has to become doctrinaire. I believe, on the other hand, he should try his best to sharpen the issues. And Dr. Newman, for example, has done work on sharpening the issue about the origin of life and the probability of that happening. There are others who have done the same things. And those are valuable exercises. And I just dearly wish that Christians would not be afraid of evolution, that they would recognize that secular scientists have a philosophical necessity to deny creation. And therefore, because of their philosophical necessity, they adopt evolution. But if you can distinguish between what is said simply because of a philosophical necessity and what is said because it is scientific fact, I think you will fare quite well. I would like to close with just a quote to illustrate the kind of quandary that the evolutionists find themselves in. And I'm quoting that famous person, Robert Jastrow. Only this time I'm going to quote him on the other side of the fence, all right? Dr. Newman's been quoting him from time to time in support of creation. Scientists have no proof that life was not the result of an act of creation, but they are driven by the nature of their profession to seek explanations for the origin of life that lie within the boundaries of natural laws. They ask themselves, how did life arise out of inanimate matter? And what is the probability of that happening? And to their chagrin, they have no clear-cut answer, because chemists can never succeed in reproducing nature's experiments in the creation of life out of non-living matter. Scientists do not know how that happened. And furthermore, they do not know the chance of it happening. Perhaps the chance is very small, and the appearance of life on a planet is an event of miraculously low probability. Perhaps life on this earth is unique in this life on this earth is unique in the universe. No evidence precludes this possibility. But while scientists must accept the possibility that life may be improbable, they have some tentative reasons for thinking that it's otherwise. And then he goes on to a discussion that, bacteria already existed when the Earth was 1 billion years old, and this means that the threshold of life was passed earlier, perhaps when the Earth was only a few 100 million years old, or even younger. A few 100 million years is not a long time for such an important experiment. If this experiment succeeded as quickly as that, the probability of its success must have been fairly high, so he concludes that maybe life is very abundant in the universe. But you see what he's saying? He's taking the fact that we are here as an argument for the probability must be high. That's the one kind of trap they get themselves into. And another kind of trap, if I can find my notes again, old saws. Creationism. Whenever they talk about creationism, that means young Earth. Whenever they talk about essentialism, that means fixity of species. No changes other than exactly the same species all the time. No variations at all. And those are just nonsense. Evolution, myth, metaphysics of science, and new science, 1982. The issue is whether evolution actually occurred. This is the question of whether the species of animals and plants we see on Earth today originally came into being in the present form, or whether they reached it through only a process of transformation from other types which existed in earlier periods. And then he goes on to say that perhaps the strongest claim for the evolution concept is by examining the alternative. Either the claim that the mass of evidence for a world very different in the past is erroneous, or some form of theory of the kind that when God created the world, he did so complete with tree rings and fossils in the rocks. You see what he's saying? He's saying it's the alternative of creation automatically means young Earth. And that's nonsense, therefore the whole thing is nonsense. This is metaphysics of its worst. For what could be counted as evidence against, let alone falsify such a belief? As Bertrand Russell said, it's always possible to conjecture that the world came into existence 5 minutes ago, complete with my memories and the holes in my socks. It illustrates that for a biologist, the alternative to thinking in evolutionary terms is not to think at all. Now that is a typical secular evolutionist's commentary on creation.
We can, you know, scientifically, we can't even admit creation, because as soon as we admit creation, there's no more need for science. And what I'm arguing is that is absolutely false, that the believing in creation leaves plenty of room for science. In fact, frees a person to take all possibilities in the scientific explanation. We can accept God as the immediate actor in a particular instance, or we can accept immediate means, if that is what happened. And what we need to do then is look for the exact evidence and the proof for what is the truth. Okay, I think I've said plenty. If there's any questions, I'll be glad to discuss them. I have a ton of quotes here. If anybody would like to question me on a particular issue or something, I'd be glad to respond. Yes?
Discussion there regarding the definition of evolution and how there's still a lot of ambiguity over what evolution itself means. What do you take?
Well, what always confused me is that whenever they give an example of evolution, it's always microevolution. It's always some small variation. And yeah, well, that's because that's all there is. But you know, then they give this example of microevolution, which I believe does occur, and then they jump and say, well, that proves evolution. Are you asking what I believe evolution is, or what I believe evolution is a legitimate term as applied to microevolution. Okay, I believe the jury is completely out on macroevolution. I don't know what a species is. I don't know whether a horse and a I don't know whether a lion and a leopard or whatever would be the appropriate cat are related by some common ancestor or not. I'm not worried about it either.
On a micro scale, you're taking evolution to be what, change or what?
Evolution would be change in species, yes. From one subspecies to another, or from one species to another, or one genera, you know, as one, what's the next above species, genus to another, possibly. Because I find it, you know, I don't think you can really pinpoint exactly what level of variation is possible by what I think is legitimate genetic variation. I don't think all genetic variation is deleterious. I think that is just pure nonsense. I think that to say that we're going to start with a reptile and end up with a bird, that's going a little bit far. But I just don't believe that happens.
But nonetheless, the evolutionary theory is just one of progressive change to higher.
Yes. And the evolutionary theory is, the classical evolutionary theory would be through natural processes. That would be through environmental pressure primarily, which is what Darwin would have argued. The modern evolutionists would say, well, we're not sure how it occurs. There appear to be sudden changes in species at times in the geological record. And perhaps this is caused by DNA insertions or, you know, transposition of genes or something like that. All of which, in one sense of the word, sounds plausible as a very low probability event, not impossible. And maybe the mechanism for certain kinds of change. I find it very hard to figure out how you develop an eye that way, or an ear, or any reasonably complicated organ. That just sounds a little bit boggling in my mind. Yes?
Some of the things were described, though, take fishes, for example.
Yes.
A variety is not between species.
Subspecies, yes.
And in many cases, change, the lack of some better way of expressing it, enabling that particular variety to cope with its environment.
Yeah.
In other words, you have one that has a different shape of beak.
Yes.
Because its food was of a different nature than the one who was a ground dweller.
There definitely is an environmental pressure as a factor. I do believe that. I believe there is a survival of the fittest to a certain extent. I don't believe that's the only mechanism. And I don't necessarily believe that, that that's the only mechanism that we had ever since the single-celled animal all the way up to the present. Yes, Dr. Newman?
Perhaps evolution then could be defined on a macroevolution scale as a theory that the phenomena that the mechanisms involved in microevolution have succeeded in producing all the variation that exists.
Yes.
In living things.
Yes.
As that they've come from one or two simple actions, from all the variation before, as a result of the kind of processes working in microevolution. And then perhaps one would say, theistic evolution would say, no, there's one rather more important thing involved that to produce any progression and any meaning on the higher level, which means organized structures, organized sub-organs of big organisms, why then you have to have a mind putting information in to construct these things. But in a theistic evolution, it would be through natural processes guided. And in a progressive creationism, it would also be interventions that would produce things that would never have even happened naturalistically, at least at some points. None of those, notice, are quite mechanisms. Well, maybe the non-theistic evolution. Although we are, I think, are willing to say, well, we don't know what the mechanism is. Here's the result. Just sort of connecting all the points on these charts of the species.
I think my inclination is not to be an evolutionist on the macro scale, but on the micro scale, I believe there are mechanisms for change. And unfortunately, those who are so inclined view the micro scale as proof of the macro. I mean, you know, it's just a different time factor. To show you the extreme that secular scientists can come to, here's a fellow Provine. Evolutionists still disagree about the precise mechanisms of evolution in nature, but they have nevertheless given overwhelming support to Darwin's belief that design in nature results from purely mechanistic causes. Modern evolutionary biology has shattered the hope, listen to this, has shattered the hope that some kind of designing or purposive force guided human evolution and established the basis of moral rules. Instead, biology leads to a wholly mechanistic view of life, as Darwin has suspected. There are no gods and there are no designing forces. The frequently made assertion that modern biology and the assumptions of the Judeo-Christian tradition are fully compatible is false. There exists no inherent moral or ethical laws, no absolute guiding principles for human society. That's a rather extreme leap, I would say. But that's a necessity for the people who don't want to admit the creator. I mean, you know, if you don't admit the creator, what's the alternative? The alternative is purely mechanistic means.
The societal issue there was recognized very early after Darwin. This isn't something modern. Huxley, Wallace all recognized you cannot build a social structure or social morality on the evolution.
Yeah. Somebody accused me of being secularist, even picked this book up in my hand. Ernst Mayr is an evolutionist, non-Christian secularist. And nonetheless, this is a tremendous book on the secular viewpoint of the growth of biological thought. He doesn't have much hold much brief for creationism. He has the same trouble that everybody else has. Creationism means young earth. And I personally think that, well, let's not get into that. Nonetheless, he mentions that too. He mentions a lot of these issues. And as some of my quotes have already observed, he doesn't say that it's a clear-cut issue, although he will not for a minute admit the creationist viewpoint, because he basically has the opinion that to admit the creator is to cut out your mind and, stop thinking. To me, that's exactly the opposite. I think it frees your mind to entertain whatever the conclusions are. Yeah.
Where does the try and fit an observation that was made in a couple of general remarks and ask for implications? You were saying that on the micro scale, evolution and change is there, it's apparent. Certain changes are just there. On the macro scale, however, you really don't see it. And when you talk about complex organs, you really wonder how in the world that could ever come to being by evolution. And yet we've observed in the case of the finches something that seems to be a little bit in between, which is a matter of the beak that's different in different cases and well adapted to the environment. And apparently we're explaining that on, or are we, explaining that on natural causes. That seems to be a little bit more than the kind of changes we're talking about on the micro scale, but
I don't see it as incompatible with the micro scale. I don't think the microevolution denies the possibility of some environmental pressure. I mean, Take cavefish, for example. You know,
it just seems like a beak is more than a cell, something that's a step in the direction of a more significant part.
But don't you admit that even the Mendelian genetics will allow some people to have short noses and some long noses, to take the equivalent of a beak?
Sure.
And it doesn't seem surprising to me that a variety might have, with a short nose, might have done better than the one with a long nose over the course. And maybe it may simply have been some of these variations on these different islands may not have been totally simply environmental pressure. They may have just been the natural result if we isolate southeastern Pennsylvania, we'll end up with a very different kind of people 500 years from now than if we isolate Texas. And maybe you can explain it by environmental pressure. Maybe you just say, well, it's just the result of genetics. You know, it just got a bunch of short Pennsylvania Dutch stock around here, and, you know, you end up short. And it has nothing to do with the fact that you can live better short in northeastern southeastern Pennsylvania than in Texas. I don't think so. Yes?
You don't have to confine it to say fish is just variety. If we go back and we think about the trilobite, there are trilobites are no longer in existence, they are existing. But there are trilobite-like animals living today that in all probability, what the changes were brought about, they are still orthopods, they are still segmented in nature. They are more complicated than the trilobite was. And they're living in a modern environment which the trilobite could not live in, evidently, or why he did become extinct, I don't know. The time he became extinct, there was a massive catastrophic event that took place throughout the world that wiped out any number of species, any number of wild animals. He passed out at about that time, too. Mm-hmm. But, I mean, there are these varieties that extend beyond the species.
I think the point was made very strongly by Mayer, for example. We don't even know what a species is. We don't know what the limits of species really are. So maybe in some cases, you know, genera might even be encompassed. I don't know, whatever.
I appreciate the idea that you speaking about that book, and I don't want to have the privilege of meeting Mayer, but I spent some time with him on the Galapagos. He's a very, very impressive man. Very knowledgeable. Very convincing.
I believe it. Having read the book.
I believe everything he says, but he was very convincing.
He's a very prolific writer. I'm sure he has at least half a dozen books almost this thick in the last decade or two on the subject of evolution primarily. Yes.
The potential for genetic exchange, manipulation, reshuffling is really extraordinary. I think at this point we can't rule anything out. For example, transpositions have really come to life only in the last 5 years.
Yeah. Yeah.
And still not very well understood.
Yeah.
The mammalian genome is so extraordinary by the gene for any one segment of coding being interrupted by a lot of segments which eventually are eliminated processing the RNA. Why these things are there, how they came to be there, bacteria don't have them, but mammalian cells do. There are segments that are repeated hundreds of thousands of times in the human genome. That's what they do.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's really quite dangerous to, when we have a propensity for doing this, for drawing conclusions without any evidence, just because people like to think one way or another. The differences between, for example, chimpanzees and orangutans and humans at the chromosome level are really very small. And it's not, I don't think, impossible or even unlikely that these small rearrangements could have happened by some type of mechanism of transposition or viral reshuffling or viral mediated reshuffling. And I think at this point we simply can't rule anything. I know you're speaking against macroevolution simply because at the current time we have no mechanisms that can really explain it. But I don't think at the same time without evidence that we can really rule it out.
I think what Dr. Bossert said a few minutes ago is the view of many physical scientists, and that is because there's a possibility that life is coded totally by these things, that any kind of change could in principle take place. But when you begin to get into changes that have an enormous number of things working together, you begin to feel that some information has been put into the situation, that it doesn't seem to us at least reasonable that the random processes were put in.
That's fine. It doesn't seem reasonable.
Well, and basically just on the feeling that random processes don't produce high levels of order in any kind of mathematical modeling that anybody knows how to do. Persons who held the macro-evolution could show by a computer model of some sort a way to generate high levels of organized information, let's say generate a language from no language, then I think that would be that whole argument would be undercut. But without that, just a switch from chimpanzee genes to human genes somehow producing the human mind seems problematic.
There are assumptions there that mathematical models are able to explain biological phenomena. That's also right. I'm not trying to argue.
I'm just trying to tell you what the problem is.
That's the devil's advocate. The area is so wide open that I think the problem all the way from the history has been that we tended to rule things out without evidence. And eventually, most of these things have improved. These assumptions, these are quick conclusions, had been proven wrong simply because they were made in haste or in without evidence. I think it would be a mistake to say that evolution started and ended with Darwin. And I like what you said. I mean, a whole new set of ideas was developed, which again at some point in time may be found inadequate. But I think the jury is still out, so the evidence is there.
I believe that philosophically or theologically, I find it very difficult to conceive of a world in which God set rules in motion and then they just carried out by purely mechanistic means. I think personally that is contrary to the whole Christian message. Now, what the specific ways are that he did interfere with the created universe, whether he interfered with it here and here and here, I think is arguable in many cases.
So what's so phenomenal, when you look at these mechanisms, I mean, perfection apparently designed into these mechanisms is so extraordinary that I don't know if you can make an assumption. I mean, maybe...
Make an assumption like what?
...designed so well that they do operate on their own.
But saying design, you've already imported that great deal of...
Yeah, right.
And if you find that a virus has a very different design than a human, did all of that design between the two get worked into it by random operation of natural processes? Or do you have to minimal, say, by providential control of random processes, and therefore have a mind inserting a great deal of information in the genetic code between the one and the other? Rather much the problem which I think a scientist again would see, physical scientist again would see, in generating Encyclopedia Britannica by random processes. And you've got too much information. The time things that you're talking about just get out of hand.
The tendency in the public literature really is for people to become the same way, but working with evolution, you get away from random processes and feel
the kind of. As a matter of fact, I was just going to say that Mayer very much pits the physicists, but the physicists are over here, the evolutionists are over here, and basically he accuses the physicists of great naivety and their mathematical modeling, because they just they're just too accustomed to simple natural laws, and they can't conceive of the complexities of the biological system, and they tend to think of things as sequential events instead of things happening simultaneously, etc. So Mayer certainly has a theme of the mathematical probabilities being very low, etc. But he says that I guess he's saying things are just so grossly complex that there's no hope. But let us have faith in biology. Yes.
There was a very interesting article that I was alerted to by one of my friends of the plant book in New Horizons. This is the orthodox.
Yes.
Little article by Davis Young who goes back through and shows what the feeling of both Hodges and Warfield was, what their reaction was to Darwin. They are incredibly favorable to Darwin.
Oh yeah, I know.
I know, B.B. Warfield in particular,
this,
yeah.
Again, gets into the whole thought that there has not been one Christian view, which is younger, literal-based creation, etc. In fact, he goes on to say that the ideas of Hodge and Warfield are such that now they probably be accused of being theistic evolutionists.
Yeah, but the irony is... The irony is that, the secular evolutionists insist on using that as the only interpretation of creationism. It's young earth.
Is it because they are naive or they are purposeful?
No, I personally think it's deliberate. I think it's, I have this little quotation, this little poem on my thing. Tiger got to hunt, bird got to fly, man got to sit and wonder why. Tiger got to sleep, bird got to land, man got to tell himself he understand. And I think that in order to convince themselves that they got the right angle on things, I think they distort the facts. I really do. I think that they set up a straw man that says all creationists have got to either be have had a lobotomy because they can't think anymore, or else they're young earth, or anybody who believes in essentialism, which basically says that species will remain species, has got to mean that there is no variation at all. I mean, all those are extreme positions, I believe. And they're sort of straw men because they don't want to even entertain the subject. I believe that a true Christian facing the scientific issues can face it with complete equanimity. He can say, well, that's right. If you show me that gorillas and chimpanzees really came from the same ancestor, wonderful, great. If you show me gorillas and cats came from the same ancestor, if you could really show it, that's fine. But, that just extends my definition of kind, I guess, since I don't know what it means anyway. Yes?
He didn't understand the scientist. What he reads is the talk about creationism in the popular press, which
again,
that's slander.
Yeah.
I really think that the scientists would hear the kinds of arguments that you and Dr. Newman have presented, and they think a great deal different. This isn't particularly widely presented.
Well, I think that's the mission of this kind of organization. I think that really is. I think that we have a sincere evangelical mission to scientists. I really do. It pains me that whether they're deliberate or not really doesn't matter. In my last paper, I said, the people that Christ was talking to weren't necessarily innocent victims. They might have been very deliberate victims, but still they were ones that Christ went to reach. And I think that these secular scientists are deliberately self-deceiving or not, I believe it's our job to clarify the issues and present the theistic alternative, I guess you would say.
Thank you very much, Dr. Foster.